It's my pleasure today to introduce Jack Gilbert. Jack is the faculty director of the Microbiome Center and a professor in the Department of Surgery at the University of Chicago Medicine. He's a senior scientist at Marine Biological Laboratory and group leader in microbial ecology at the Argonne National Laboratory. So for a person so young, I'm extremely impressed. Dr. Gilbert's research is focused on the ecology, evolution, and metabolic dynamics of microbial ecosystems from a myriad of environments, including built environments, oceans, rivers, soils, air, plants, animals, and humans. His primary interest is in using omics technologies, metagenomics, metatranscriptomics, and metabolomics, to capture longitudinal dynamics in microbial ecosystems and then model how these interactions relate to environmental variables, be those variables disease onset and immunology in humans or chemical transformations in plants and soils. Dr. Gilbert is developing unifying principles which govern how microbial communities assemble. He founded the Earth Microbiome Project and co-founded the American Gut Project and is the editor-in-chief of the Journal of M Systems. I'm not exactly sure I'm going to be able to follow this, but I'm going to thoroughly enjoy it. I would like to introduce Dr. Gilbert. Thank you.
It may be a little bit strange to have a surgeon on the podium in front of Horticultural Society. I'm not a surgeon. Actually, I trained as an entomologist. I trained as a butterfly specialist, Lepidoptera, before becoming a microbiologist for a brief period of time, working for the company Unilever, trying to identify proteins in Antarctica that can make ice cream taste smoother. From there on, my career has been downhill. But I have, for the last 10 years, been working in soil plant-associated microbial interactions and relationships associated with plant productivity, crop disease resistance, stress resilience. And it's only for the want of money that I got switched over and I'm also working in medical microbiome research. So in my mind, all of these are interconnected. I'm an ecologist by training and by passion. But what I try and do is apply microbial ecological theory and practice to as many different environments as possible. It's just easy that there are microbes everywhere, so I don't have to really worry about transforming any of that knowledge in between different institutions. I just have to pretend that I know what a surgeon does and a boat is, etc. And I try and continually adapt and change to the new ecosystems which we work in. The Microbiome Center at University of Chicago is a very multidisciplinary initiative. We have marine biologists and terrestrial ecologists and biologists from virtually every discipline you can possibly imagine across three different institutions. And so what we try and do is bring together groups of people who wouldn't normally interact and get them talking to each other, which is fun, you know. It's like trying to learn multiple new languages all at the same time, especially when you get the immunologists on side who have their own language all to themselves. I like to start with this quote. This is one of my favorite quotes from one of my colleagues at University of British Columbia. Once the diversity of the microbial world is catalogued, it will make astronomy look like a pitiful science. It makes sense, right? There are one time centre of 30 bacterial cells alone in the oceans. If you take in the terrestrial landmass as well, that number becomes exponentially larger. And then if we look at the number of stars in the known universe, not in the galaxy, in the universe, it's estimated to be about 1 times 10 to the 24, 1 times 10 to the 25. So there are more bacteria in the ocean than there are stars in the universe. And therefore, when somebody says, God, that pizza was astronomically expensive, you can tell them, no, it was microbiologically expensive. It never really goes down well, but, you know, you can try it. To try and understand that, in 2010, a group of us got together and we formed what we call the Earth Microbiome Project, which is a large-scale, multidisciplinary, international initiative. And the idea was, hey, you know, if you had unlimited amounts of money, how would you go about cataloguing the diversity of life on this planet? And the vast majority of it is microbial. 99.9% of life on this planet is microbial in terms of weight and diversity. So we wanted to, you know, get into that, try and figure out how many bacterial species there were, where were they distributed, what were they associated with, what were their functional ecotypes like. It was one of those pie in the sky ideas that really no one ever thought would take off, and we thought, well, we'll try it and see what happens. We just published our first paper last year, and that had about 400 authors on it, which was kind of insane. But the idea is to provide contribution to those people who want to be part of something bigger, not necessarily just their own little research idea, but something that would have true, far-reaching, integrated consequences. We processed over 100,000 samples, which sounds like a lot, but is actually just a drop in the proverbial global ocean, or the literal global ocean, and soil, and animals, and feces. That's because we got lots of different biomes represented, humans, animals, we have air samples, we have soil and plant samples from literally every continent on Earth, including Antarctica. We've produced over 10 billion 16S ribosomal RNA sequences. We've started to generate a lot of metagenomic data as well. That's the genetic information of all the microbes there, producing over 1.2 million unique sequences for a public data analysis. That's an important component, right? We make all the data available literally the moment it comes off of the sequencing machine. It's quite hard to sometimes upload some of this data. The online servers don't like you dumping terabytes worth of information on them at the drop of a hat. But the idea is that we get it out there. We're not so worried about being scooped, because if anyone can process this data faster than us, then we want them involved in the project. The idea is more to allow people to have access to those resources. We actually founded the journal M Systems, which is an association, American Society for Microbiology. There, I'm getting all my A's mixed up. ASM Journal, on the principle of data sharing, what we call data parasitism. We were once accused of being data parasites because we go out there and we take other people's data and we, you know, analyze it, which is kind of what it's there for. So, you know, the idea is that we go out, we generate data, we put it in the public domain, we invite people to come along and use it, we make it as accessible as possible so that people can actually start to dig down and integrate and understand that data. So the first key paper came out, as I say, at the end of last year, and this is actually just the first 28,000 samples that were processed and analyzed. We obviously have samples from lots of different animals and different parts of the world, plants, soils. We have saline and non-saline environments, and that was a key differentiation. There are saline soils and non-saline soils, saline water, non-saline water, and the presence of salt, obviously as a great electron reducer acceptor, is one of the key components which drives biological life on this planet. This is what we'd call the principal coordinate plot up here in the top left-hand side. Obviously up there you can see that there are lots and lots of different samples in there, 28,000 of them, and they form this continuum of biological diversity space. So a principal coordinate spot, every single one of those dots is a microbial community. It's the sum total, the distribution of many, many different species of organisms and their abundances. And if the dots are closer together, those ecosystems are more similar to each other than if they're further apart. It's pretty simple. And you can see, you know, we've colored that by whether it's saline or non-saline environments. But there's a continuum of biological diversity space throughout that paradigm, right? And then you can do simple things like you can say, well, what's the most diverse environment? Obviously it's soils, it's sediments, it's the places where you have rich, multi-niche spaces. So, you know, even a soil grain, only 20% of soil is actually colonized by microbial life. 80% of it's barren. There are no biofilms, there are no bacterial cells. For every soil grain, only 20% of it's probably going to be covered. But it provides all of these micro niches, this amazing rich contextual space that allows all of the microbial organisms to differentiate on an epic scale, providing a huge amount of diversity space. Similar is true for sediments, Microbes love living on surfaces. You give them a surface, they'll stick to it, they'll grow on it, they'll propagate. And so soils and sediments with all the particulate material in there are incredibly valuable. And then, you know, you can break it down. We actually had to create our own ontology to really understand and allow machine reading capability. So computers could read our data. We wanted to tell those computers exactly where these samples came from. And so we created our own ontology which described the sample types. And we break it down at the first point into whether the organisms can survive outside of another organism, right? If I took all of Carl's bacteria, a lot of them couldn't survive outside of Carl, right? And Carl wouldn't survive either, sorry, mate. But if so we could go, yeah, if it's free living, if it can survive outside of a host, another animal or a plant, then it's a different organism to one that's host associated. And then we have saline and non-saline. If it's host associated, we'd have whether it lives in an animal or a plant, and then we break it down even further. And so that ontology is actually now widely available and used by NCBI, Genbank, EBI, all of the nucleotide repositories, and came out of a long 10-year program to try and standardize those languages through something called the Genomic Standards Consortium, which if you ever want to smash your head against a brick wall for eternity, start doing data standards with a large group of people in the room. It's a wonderful experience. Requires alcoholism. One of the findings that I'm most excited about, and it's kind of boring, but it proves a point that we demonstrated about 10 years ago in the oceans, is that microbes appear to be really well distributed across the planet, right? I can find bacteria living, literally the same organism of bacteria living in Central Park in New York. I can find that same organism in the steppes out of Mongolia, right? You know, the organisms have small genetic changes, but on the whole, they're highly adapted to living with certain ecosystem properties, be that the roots of a plant and the root exudates that occur there, or the saline or the nitrogen and phosphorus properties. So we find distribution of that potential across the world. In fact, I'm engaged right now in a study across China and the United States to identify the bacteria that are associated, symbiotically associated with tree leaves, across a disjunction, an evolutionary disjunction that occurred between the forests of America and the forests of China. Because 60 million years ago, or 48 million years ago, they were part of the same forest, right? It was only when that continent broke up about 48 million years ago that forest got separated. And so we actually have the same kind of tree phylogenies distributed across what is now the eastern coast of the US and the eastern coast of China. And they actually have the same kinds of bacteria living in their leaves, even after 48 million years, which I think is kick-ass. You can see my American vernacular is coming on very well. But what this shows is that we have a load of particular samples down here, only about 2,000 of them. And over here on the right, we have really diverse samples. So those samples have lots of different types of bacteria in them. And over on the left, we have really low diverse samples, not many bacteria in them. And the key takeaway is that all of the ones that have low diversity contain bacterial types which are present in the highly diverse environments. So again, if I look at, I'm going to pick on Carl continuously. If I take Carl's poop, for example, and I look at his bacteria, I'm taking the shit out of Carl, sorry. And I look at his it is quite fun, thank you. And I take his bacteria, I find bacteria living there that are found in many other mammalian species. And actually they have a similar phylogenetic history to some organisms living in the ocean present in fish species. There is a phylogenetic distribution, you know. We as an organismal group of multicellular life have evolved in a sea, literally and figuratively, of microbes. Right? So we've always built up, we've developed that context and created a life force present with a symbiotic relationship to microbial life. So of course things are distributed and they occur. And so a low diverse environment is just picking organisms from a highly diverse environment that can survive in that low diverse, very selective ecosystem. A soil environment is highly diverse and it seeds the microbial life of a plant. That is a highly selective environment. We also find that, you know, when we go down to the subspecies level, I'm talking about individual strains of bacteria, we find for the most part, up here I have genera, So bacterial genera, Escherichia is a genera, Pseudomonas is a genera. I've got lots of different bacterial genera up there, and they're quite well distributed. Every single genera is found in lots of different environments, right? So the genera have high distribution. When I get down to strain level, this is subspecies, unique genotypic organisms, I find that some of them have a very high level of distribution across the planet's ecosystems, and some of them, like here, this is organisms which are only found in the rhizosphere, here in green, right? So these are organisms which are highly enriched in that space, and they're very, They're very adapted, super adapted to that environment. Using this kind of information, this kind of data, we can start to model some of the characteristics of microbial distribution on this planet. And nobody can tell me I'm wrong, because it would be too expensive to do it. So call this an experiment in fun. Let's say we actually have a lot of model parameters for global soils, for example. This is one of them, soil moisture, distributed across the planet in a pretty spinning globe. I can use the environmental characteristics, the pH, the salinity, the moisture content, the nitrogen content, etc., the dissolved organic carbon material, particulates. I can use all that information, I can plug it into, we have an artificial neural network that's been trained on the distribution and abundance of bacterial taxa associated with these characteristics. I can use that to predict the distribution, the relative proportions of different organisms. Here I'm choosing alpha proteobacteria, which is kind of like saying insects, right? It's a huge phylogenetic category, but it makes a nice picture. So we can now predict the relative proportions of alpha proteobacteria across the global soil environment at a scale, a very crude scale. I'm talking about like a half kilometer squared, right? But it gives us an ability to predict things at a scale that's relevant to the globe. And then I can use that, the proportions of the individual organisms, to predict what kind of functional potential that ecosystem might have. So if I've got 20% of my community being a particular species of Pseudomonas, then I can say, well, I've got a lot of Pseudomonas genomes in my database. Let's just take the average of that functional potential for Pseudomonas and say, yeah, you know, 20% of this community has this functional potential. It's hand waving. It's completely extrapolative, but it provides us with an ability to make some specific statements which can then be tested experimentally. So here I pick cellular biocidase, and looking at the relative abundance of the genes associated with that process across the global soil environment. I can use that data. If I know how the functional potential of the microbial community changes, I can now start to predict the relative turnover of particular metabolites. So, for example, carbon dioxide. This isn't an actual flux measurement. It's what we call a relative computational predictive flux, which is a way of saying we don't know if it's real, but it's there, right? And we can now say that the microbial community has the ability to either synthesize, compared to average, a greater proportion of carbon dioxide in that soil, or synthesize a lower proportion of carbon dioxide in that soil. Obviously, we cannot relate that to how much CO2 the soil actually generates, because that is predicated on many different physical and biological phenomena, such as plants, which get in the way of everything. But that provides us with a framework in which to say, yeah, you know, if I took that soil and I incubated it in the lab, in the absence of the plant, what would be the carbon dioxide production capability? And interestingly, we have an accuracy based on assessing over 200 different soils from this kind of property of about 60 to 65%, which ain't bad for a bunch of hand-waving nonsense, in my opinion. So these are just fun strategies to see if we can extrapolate microbiological processes and dynamics at a global scale. We're good, but not very good. A lot of work to be done there. Working with Noah Fiera, who's a colleague of mine down at Colorado, back in 2012, we went out into different environments to determine if we could use some of these extrapolative models to predict what kind of microbes were essential for some bioenergy crops, such as big blue stem, right? Obviously, the kind of the environment those come from were the Great Prairie. The Great Prairie used to extend around this kind of spatial area, all the way from North Texas through Oklahoma, up into Illinois. A lot of Illinois used to be prairie, and then all the way up into the north, up into Canada. And so what we did is we actually went into old Civil War graveyards at night. And old Civil War railways depots, right? Places where there had never really been an influx of nitrogen-based fertilizers. So we wanted to look at places where the agricultural revolution never really occurred. And so you had a lot of the old prairie environment. And what we found there is when we went into those environments across this gradient of space, we found that there was an enrichment for bacteria associated with some of the prairie grasses in that environment that were completely absent in the heavily fertilized, agriculturally productive fields and sites, which is now 97% of Illinois. And it was fascinating. One of the key organisms or key group of organisms that was enriched in that space was Verruca microbia, which we know very little about. It's really hard to cultivate. It loves being in a carbon-rich environment. It hates, it's very non-competitive in a nitrogen-rich environment. So when you add a lot of nitrogen fertilizers, it dies out and other things take over. But it's very, very closely associated with these big blue stem bioenergy crops associated with prairie grasses. The key thing is we extrapolated the relative proportions of this organism, Verruca microbia, or group of organisms, across the old prairie range by taking an association between the abundance at the different, you know, creepy graveyard and railway sites that we selected, and linking it to the climate at that particular location. So the local weather patterns averaged over a year. And by doing that, we could distribute the relative proportions of this organism across this gradient. And the model for that had a really good fit. So we were, took 10% of the data from our study, mapped it to climate, and were able to predict the other 90% of the data with about a 75% accuracy. So that's a pretty good fit. So there's a really strong distribution, and Verruca microbia would have been very, very rich in the middle of the prairie range, where you had the good soil conditions and the abundance of the prairie grasses for it, and less so on the outside of the range, where temperature, moisture, and other species, plant species, come in and disrupt that relationship. Verruca microbia, so it's very hard to culture, it loves carbon, and we can actually map its functional potential across this gradient as well. The actual diversity of functional genes from the microbial community in soils goes way, way, way down in the middle of the predicted range of Verruca microbia, and that's because only Verruca microbia dominates. So you've got a few organismal species which suddenly become super abundant in the Verruca microbia, and they dominate the whole system and prevent other organisms from growing. And so you get a very, very low functional diversity because you've only got really one or two or three species of organisms surviving in that environment. And that really helped us to pin down what that organism was. In those samples, it was sometimes 50% of the community was one or two ecotypes of this one species. And we called it DA101, a really boring name, Candidatus ubiquitae, because it's found everywhere. We mapped this genome of this one species to data sets that were collected from different soils around the world, and nearly every environment where you have grasses, this organism, this one genotype, dominates. For example, if I take Table Mountain in South Africa, we see a significant dominance of this one particular genotype of the Verruca microbia in that sample type. Ooh. If I look at our prairie study, yes, it was one of the most abundant. If I look at grasslands generally around the world from thousands of different sites, again, it's one of the most abundant. Even in Central Park, remember I said earlier Central Park has some organisms which are found everywhere? Well, this is one of them. This species in the grasslands in Central Park is incredibly abundant. You go in the forests, not so abundant, right? So it's an organism which has found ubiquity distributed around the world through association with different plant species. How does it distribute? We don't know. Maybe on the backs of seeds and on pollen, maybe drifting in the wind, you know. I could go into a Kansas song right there, but we don't know. But these are really interesting questions that are going to need some more studies to answer. Kansas has lots of prairie grasses as well, so there was a relevance. We can also map this a little bit further, map it to changes in climate. So for example, here we've got soil samples collected across the North American continent, and as a proxy, soil samples collected across the Tibetan Plateau. And we mapped the relative proportions, the changing community structure, the whole microbial community, we mapped it to the climatological changes that we were seeing in those places. So if I play this video, it starts in 1900, and they're seeing this significant shifts year to year in the microbial community structure in the Tibetan Plateau as we go for the 100 years. So now in the 1950s, 60s, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, you start to see the whole system undergoes rapid, much more significant fluctuation changes. And it's getting worse. So obviously no one can tell me I'm wrong. I'll play that again. You can see it's very stable at the beginning of the 20th century. The stability is year on year isn't much, has small fluctuations, not great. And it's not until the 60s, then the 70s, and into the 80s that we start to see really rapid fluctuations and dynamics. This paper's about to be published. We can use this to predict what's going to happen to the microbial communities. We can't say what the impact of that will be, but we know what's going to happen to them. They're going to become more diverse. Why are they going to become more diverse? Climate change may alter the structure of the community. Well, it's going to knock out some of those really dominant species. And when you knock out a dominant species, other species can become more abundant. And therefore, you can start to see more different species. More different species? Is that even good English? Is that good English, Carl? Yeah. It's close enough, yeah. So we start to see an increase in species diversity in the microbial community because that community is undergoing a dynamic change in its ecological stability. Interestingly, this number has changed. It should be 50 years. But we can predict the bacterial community structure today based on the climate from about 50 years previous. Right, which may mean something, may mean nothing. We think that soil properties and the plants that drive those properties are working on a much longer multi-decadal scale to shape microbial properties in the soil based on the amount of particulate and dissolved organic carbon, the amount of material that's present in that environment, than we ever thought possible. So that in a stable environment, it takes a long time to build up the carbon properties which shape the microbes, and those microbes are responding to things that have been happening in the last 50 years, not yesterday, which you'd expect for a fast-growing organism. But remember, these are ecological processes which take decades to mature. We've followed this up with a study across eastern China looking at forest soils, and here we map the bacterial community, the fungal community, and the archaeal community. Archaea are like little bacteria archaea and a bacteria got together to make a eukaryote, right? So they're an ancient group of prokaryotes. But we took 110 soil samples from across eastern China, going from areas that are very dry, usually in the north, to areas that are permanently moist in the south. And so we have a gradient of climatological variance, different climate regions colored here in different colors, but also a gradient of soil moisture availability, which shapes how that microbial community is dynamic, how it changes. And we can use this, we can actually map these relationships. So this is what we call a co-association network. So we see if one species becomes abundant, how many other species become abundant with it? And if it becomes less abundant, how many other species become less abundant? And if they follow the same pattern over space, then we can map them. We can say they have a statistical relationship. So every single one of these lines is a highly significant, very powerful statistical relationship of at least 0.7 Spearman's row. So what we end up with are very, very tight relationships mapped out in space between the bacteria, the fungi, and the archaea across this environment. There are 66,000 associations that are very, very strong across this gradient, and 90% of those are globally distributed across the entire of the climatological patterns. So it doesn't matter if you're in the dry north or in the wet south, there are partnerships between the bacteria, the fungi, and the archaea, which are universal, right? And that's really important. If you want to restore these environments, if you want to take some of those properties and apply them into agricultural processes, it's good to know that you have robust relationships that don't change if the patterns of the soil and the climate change, right? Because those are going to be very resilient to shifts and therefore could be very valuable to agricultural practice. However, 10% of those properties are also region-specific. i.e. they're found only in the south, only in the middle near Shanghai, or only in the far north. And we can actually look at properties of those network structures, properties of those network structures which may be shifting that relationship or explain some components of that relationship. And so here we have connectivity. And network connectivity is much greater in the north. That means that there are species which have a lot more partnerships, right? It's like social media. The Facebook profiles of the bacteria in the north have a lot more friends than the Facebook profiles of the bacteria in the south. What does that mean? Well, that means they've got closer, more specific relationships. Facebook's probably crap at that, because I know loads of people on Facebook I don't know. But, all right, you know, like your friendships. I'm really bad at analogies. Really, I've got to work on my analogies, Carl. But understanding those partnerships is important. Remember, the bacteria in the north have very little moisture between the sand grains or the soil grains. So if you're living on this one and your friend's over here, you can't communicate with them because there's air in between your communication, and you're not very good at firing metabolites across air, right? So you end up only communicating chemically with the microbes that are living on your soil, on your sand grain or your soil grain, right, in your own biofilm. And so you get these little, very discrete communities built up across each of the individual components. That means that you are very, very dependent upon the people living in your biofilm on your soil grain, right? And completely independent virtually of the organisms living over here. So it makes those dependencies much stronger, right? If you go into the south where it's more moist, you have much more promiscuity, because you can be living on this with your buddies, right? But because there's a lot of moisture between the soil grains, you can have chemical relationships, chemical communication with the guys living on this soil grain. And that means that you have a much broader network of potential to interact with, which creates a more stable ecosystem because there's a lot less dependency on these very tight relationships. But it also makes it much more clearer that you have fewer very strong relationships and much more a lot more weaker relationships with the rest of the community. And again, that's very important to understand if your relationships are strong or weak, because if you can tailor and engineer those relationships to be strong or weak, then you can have a much better chance at managing the predictability of your environment. We've used this with low-input smallholder tropical agricultural groups in Africa to try and understand the impact of different fertilization strategies on those strong or weak relationships. So we can see functional capacity within the microbial community was actually maximized when fertilizers were combined with legume rotations, adding organic matter to the soil. And we've just followed this up. I don't have a slide around this, but we've those functional capacities are driven by increasing organic matter, which adds to the strength of some of the core relationships, which are not only robust to physicochemical and biological shifts in the community, but are also robust to some of the environmental constraints that might occur because of agricultural practice. However, so we did the same analysis on rice crops across, and wheat crops across China, across about 15 different agricultural regions across China, and we're just trying to publish that paper now, showing that the organic matter composition in the different sites is very much shaped by the types of bacterial relationships which occur in those sites. Not the other way around. We always thought that the microbes would be responding to the organic carbon, which was a property of the plants that were present there. But when we transfer microbes from one plant to another, we see it shifts over a very, very long timescale. It shifts the organic properties, organic matter properties of the soil environment, and changes the actual productivity and stability of that soil for crop productivity and for disease resistance in those crops. Interestingly, a company, that is a weed plant, a colleague of mine, Matt Wallenstein, Colorado State, he took some of the stuff that we've been working on and some organisms which he'd identified, and we genome sequenced and commercialized them. And so we couldn't break into wheat and crops, wheat and legumes and other large-scale crops, because it's just too much of a difficult industry to get into. So living in Colorado back in 2015, he went into weed. Now I think the company GrowSentia is doing very well. It's produced a formula based on a bacterial organism, a probiotic formulation of two different organisms, which when added to the soil activates phosphate usually biounavailable phosphate or recalcitrant phosphate, from the soil chemical matrix and allows it to become bioavailable to the plant, right? So it's creating a new paradigm. And they actually have 16% increase in bud yield, right? That's pretty cool, isn't it? I have no idea. But sounds awesome. Or stem strength, you get 6% stem strength. Is that important for getting high? Is stem strength important? He knows, I know he knows. Look at that. No one has that kind of moustache if they're not smoking weed. sorry. I think every week on Facebook they have like a how big are your buds competition, and you get like a free supply for a week if you've got big buds. So I think it's important. So this is a cool company, right? You know, people are actually taking this and trying to apply it to novel agricultural biotechnological solutions. Just spinning out, because Carl said I could talk a little bit about human health as well. And even though you all love plants and whatever else and soils, you're also all human. And I'll wager most of you have some kind of health issue that you're really worried about, or you know, or just concerned about your health. So it's important to understand that what goes for your plants also goes for you. Right, we've actually applied a lot of the ecological processes, dynamics, and statistical methodologies that we've built working in soil and marine environments into the human microbiome research. So we actually apply a lot of that technology. And every single one of you is a microbial organism, just like a plant. You have around 40 trillion bacterial cells inside your body. It's about the same number of bacterial cells as human cells. If you ever heard in the media like there's 10 times more bacteria in your body than there are humans, that's not true. That was just a back-of-the-envelope calculation from a 1960s textbook, which was completely based on nonsense, much like the models. But it's not true, right? We've now done estimates based on actual measurements, and it's around about the same one-to-one number. But they do have around 100 times more genes than you do. You have around 27,000 genes in your genome, and they have around between 3 to 7 million, depending upon the types of organisms you have. And that's important because every single one of you has a unique complement of bacterial strains. There are some organism species and genera which are very, very common, but the strains are very individual and you usually inherit them from your mother. Microbes can affect your life in many ways. The bacteria living on your skin, for example, actually consume your sweat and various other oil exudates on your skin, and they produce aromatic compounds and volatile compounds, which are actually sensed by mosquitoes, which can lead to a significant increase in attraction. I have a lot of those bastards living on my skin. I'm very attractive to mosquitoes. My wife has none. So she just takes me. If she wants to go walking in the wilds of, like, you know, northern Wisconsin, she takes me along as her mosquito repellent because they don't go near her. Tylenol, acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol, is actually converted by some organisms into some liver toxic compounds which can have significant impacts. So if you have the wrong kind of bacteria living in your gut and you take Tylenol on a regular basis, it can increase the chances of liver toxicity. So we're now using that as a potential way of determining which kind of painkiller for long-term pain relief would be ideal for you. That is a picture down in the bottom left of Two Flies Humping, which is a great name. It was the name of a new album I'm working on. Or a band, I haven't chosen yet. It could be the band or the album name. Two Flies Humping. We've actually shown that we can change mate selection in flies by altering the bacterial organisms present in their gut. And this has actually led to a significant change in our understanding of how the gut communicates with the brain. Bacteria in the gut produce neurotransmitters like gamma-aminobutyric acid, GABA. They produce things like serotonin precursors, which actually provide almost 70% of the serotonin in your body comes from bacteria interacting with colonocytes, the cells lining your gastrointestinal tract, right? Huge amount of neurotransmitter burden coming from your gut. Most of those don't get into the brain, but they activate sensors and receptors around your body, which change your neurological impulses and can actually alter the neurochemistry of your brain. Via the central nervous system. So we now know that we can actually alter behavior both in invertebrates and invertebrates. We've done it in mice and rats by affecting the types of bacteria which live in the gut. So we're putting all this information into medical records. We're calling that precision medicine, precision microbial medicine, which has been highly important in trying to drive forward an understanding of why some people get sick and some people don't, why some people respond to drugs and some people don't. We can't tell it from your genome, but we can tell a lot from your bacterial population. So why is this important? We developed something called microbiome-wide association studies. We use exactly the same techniques as we did for plants, but when you talk to an epidemiologist or a clinician, they want to hear things in a certain way because they're programmed to only listen to certain types of words. So you just change the way you say things, right? It was microbial ecology, now it's microbiome research. It was ecological statistics, now it's microbiome-wide association studies. Microbiome-wide association study is exactly the same as a genome-wide association study, which they can digest and understand. And that's just when you look at the genes or the alleles of the genes which are associated with the disease. We do exactly the same thing with microbes. But the important thing is microbes are all different. You've got lots of them in your gut. As they say, about 1,000 species, maybe 500 to 1,000 species in every person. And they're little chemical factories, right? So they're producing all of these novel metabolites. So you can see... Everything, they can actually produce amino acids. So if you are on a protein-restricted diet and you have bacteria in your gut that produce a lot of amino acids, that can actually help you to sustain your physiological health. If you become malnourished, you don't get enough protein, you'll start consuming your muscles and you get breakdown and you start excreting urea. Well, some people have a lot of bacteria that produce a lot of amino acids in their gut, which actually supplements their protein pool and stops them from breaking down their muscles. So they can actually survive under periods of malnutrition. So we work with a group in Jamaica working on that particular research. I said the acetaminophen story. Remember, microbes break down acetaminophen, producing acetaminophen sulfate, which can be toxic for your liver. They produce a lot of secondary compounds, both compounds to help them to communicate and compounds that actually lead to communication between host cells. And they even break down things like your gallbladder acids, so your bile acids coming out of your gallbladder. They break them down, producing secondary bile acids, which could play a significant role in protecting the body from infections, so bad bacteria. So they actually change out your body's chemistry in order to prevent bad bacteria from colonizing the body. They're very protective. The important thing about that and about all of these studies is that everything touches everything. So if you understand a change in one thing will have ripples through the stream which will affect other components of the system. Everything is connected. That's the reason ecology is super important for human health. And just like any ecosystem, we've been wiping out that environment. So if I take out the trees in the Amazon, I affect the hydrology of that environment, which can affect local climate, which can affect animal populations and human and crops productivity for people. We understand that removal of particular organisms can have big impacts on how the system works. And there are lots and lots of different diseases which are being affected by this, everything from cancer and IBD, all the way through to things that can actually affect it, like hyperphagia, which is you can't stop eating. Literally, if I finished my plate, I'd probably punch Carl in the face and steal his lunch if I was hyperphagic, because I would be so hungry, I wouldn't want to even ask him, I'd just take it. And we worked with some children with that disease. It's quite bad, but we can affect it by altering their microbial community. We can actually reduce the hyperphagia down to a manageable level. Exercise and smoking, alcohol and breast milk are next to each other. I don't know why. It might be me. Whatever floats your boat. But those kind of things have an impact upon what can live inside your body. Your diet does, right? You eat a high-fat diet, you're going to promote an increase in the growth of bacteria which love a lot of fat. If you eat a lot of fiber, you promote the ones that like a lot of fiber. It's all connected. And so we've actually shown that if you have, say, an infection, a C. diff infection, Clostridium difficile, a recurrent one, we can actually alter the environment of your gut by replacing the community of organisms in your gut with one that actually works through something called a fecal microbiome transplant. Same as, like your tree's not doing well, you rip out all the crap soil and you put in a load of healthy soil, right? Exactly the same as in the colon. We literally will give you a bunch of antibiotics and give you a bowel wash, and then we will spray, literally like a hose, poop up inside your colon from a healthy donor. And remarkably, it has a, if we just give you the antibiotics, it gives you a 30% cure rate for recurrent C. difficile infection. That's recurrence within 6 months. If we give you a fecal microbiome transplant, you get a 94% success rate. And there have been 25,000, or 27,000 fecal microbiome transplants done in the US over the last 7 years, and still has a success rate of over 90%, which is pretty much unparalleled for any other drug. That's just changing the ecosystem. You've got bad bugs in there, let's get rid of the bad bugs, put good bugs back, right? And the good bugs actually break down your bile acids, like I said before, from the gallbladder, right? And they make secondary bile acids, which actually prevent C. diff from growing. So we think that the environment's been changing, our environment's been changing. We used to play outside or work outside, now we play inside. And inside we're not exposed to very many microbes. Our exposure level's gone down. And we clean and sterilize everything as much as possible, killing good and bad bacteria. And this actually leads to a reduction in our exposure, which has a big role to play in shaping how our immune system functions, leading to a significant reduction or a pro-inflammatory status. We think that by adding some bacteria back into the body, we may actually be able to help the immune system develop properly in people and therefore protect them from allergens like asthma or allergic diseases like asthma or food allergies or seasonal allergies. In a study we did with the Amish and the Hutterite populations in North America on farming communities, we determined there was a significant difference between Amish and Hutterites in the kind of exposure they got. And that we think that was associated with their allergic disease reaction. The Amish have about 4% asthma in their population. The Hutterites have almost 25 to 30%. So almost three times the national average and about seven times the Amish. And the Amish live on a farm, right? The kids work on the farm in the morning. They work on the farm after school. I take my kids to those farms to show them that a child can survive without an iPad and can have a job. Whereas on the Hutterite community, the farm and the housing environment are completely separated. So only the men work on the farm and the children stay at home around the farm, and they never get the exposure to the farm that the Amish kids get. And when we look at their immune systems, they're completely different. So blue is Amish and red is Hutterite. The Amish have more neutrophils up there in the top left in the blue. Neutrophils are the little scout cells from the immune system that run around looking for foreign objects, right? So if you're exposed to more foreign objects, you're going to have more neutrophils because you need to make more scouts to detect all those foreign objects coming in. And you think that would be bad, but actually that leads to a significant reduction in the eosinophils that is here. The Amish have very few eosinophils, which are pro-inflammatory cells. The Hutterite have lots of pro-inflammatory cells, right? And the Hutterite's neutrophils are actually they're old compared to the Amish neutrophils. So these three boxes here represent cell surface markers on the outside of your neutrophil. And if you have more of those cell surface markers, your neutrophils are older, right? And they've been in circulation for longer because they ain't seen anything, because there's nothing to see. So they stay in circulation. And when they stay in circulation, they get these cell surface markers, they get sticky. They start sticking together and they cause a much bigger pro-inflammatory response when they finally see an allergic or an allergen, right? And we can show that in mice. We take dust from the bedrooms of Amish kids and we blow it into the respiratory tracts of mice. And it actually stimulates their immune system in a specific way, which protects them from an allergy. All right, so we give these mice an allergy. We then spray the Amish dust into their noses, and it seems to alter their immune system response, so they're no longer allergic to the allergen, which obviously has potential consequences for reducing allergies in our community and asthma rates in our community. Obviously, I'm not saying we go like start raiding the Amish farms and gathering up their dust. We're trying to figure out what the active components are, because otherwise they're going to start making a killing out of that. Yeah, yo, you want to buy some of my dust, eh, Englishman? Yeah, I'll give you some. Be great. Make a thing. Obesity is linked to the microbiome. One of my colleagues used to weigh almost 385 pounds. He lost 113 pounds by going on a traditional Chinese whole grain diet for 9 months. And he looked at his microbiome before the diet and after the diet. And after the diet, he was missing an organism that he had at the beginning. There's one bacteria, Enterobacter cloacea B29, was about 3% of his community before, at below the level of detection afterwards. And when we added it into a mouse, it changed the mouse's shape. I don't know if you can see the difference between the two mice. But one of them's got Enterobacter cloacea B29 in it and one hasn't. They're both eating the same amount of calories, the same type of food, they have the same level of activity. But one is having its entire physiological system altered by the chemicals that this bacteria is producing, which is affecting how its body responds to food energy. And in fact, we've shown that when people eat mice. We have mice. When mice eat a high-fat diet, and we put a lot of high fat in there, it alters the bacteria that can grow. As I said, they produce, bacteria that love fat, they'll start growing. And those bacteria produce chemicals like hydrogen sulfide in enough of a concentration that it seeps into the blood and can actually affect how some of the transcriptional regulatory gene pathways work in different organs that aren't in the gut. So, for example, here, you feed a mouse a lot of high fat, it disrupts the microbial community completely. They start to produce hydrogen sulfide, which disrupts the circadian rhythm genes, the genes that tell your liver what's day or night, right? And that actually affects food energy you put into storage, i.e. fat, versus respiration. We see exactly the same thing when people are working nights or when they're jet lagged. Their circadian rhythm genes in their internal organs is completely disrupted compared to what their brain's thinking. When you eat a high-fat diet, a regular high-fat diet, and I'm talking bad fats, not good fats for the nutritionists in the room, you can tell me what those are, that'd be great. It decouples your body's circadian rhythm from your brain exactly the same way as it would if you flew to Singapore right now, right? You'd have a disruption. So we're really interested in that pattern and how we can leverage it to reduce weight gain. And I just want to end on a study from two of my colleagues from the Wiseman Institute. I wasn't involved in this, but full disclosure, I was a scientific advisory board or director of the scientific advisory board for the company that they generated for this stuff. And Carl said some of you are interested in nutrition, so I think this is a really interesting story. It's a couple of slides, it'll be a bit of fun. So we really want to get into personalized nutrition, and trying to understand personalized nutrition has a really long history, which I won't go into, but it starts way back before this, but it really started in terms of trying to understand people individually when we started looking at the genome and seeing if there were markers in the genome that could predict how people might be responding to certain types of food. And then 2010, we started looking at the microbiome, and it quickly became apparent that when we took the microbiome of an obese person and put it into a mouse, the mouse would gain weight. Or if we found Enterobacter crassi B29 and stuck it in a mouse, the mouse would gain weight. So there had to be a relationship between the bacteria living in your gut, right, and how much weight you gained from your diet, right? Now we're in a position of precision medicine, an actionable precision medicine. We really wanted to get on board with trying to see if we could weaponize that kind of research and make it available to people so they could make the right kinds of choices about the diet that were unique to them. And there weren't very many groups. We've been trying to do it in Chicago. There's a group out in UCSD who've made a lot of progress, one in Stanford, one in Harvard, and a group at Caltech. But nobody had quite managed to commercialize it, right, in a way that was effective. This group at the Wiseman Institute, what they did is they started to look at how the body responded to the particular diet when you have particular types of microbes in your gut. And then these guys formed this company in 2015 called Day 2 in order to commercialize that understanding. And it works like this, right? So you have a lot of inputs. You have a microbiome. We can take your blood test and look at what's going on inside the blood. They take a questionnaire. They take anthropomorphic measurements like your amount of body mass you have, your circumference, etc. And then they take a basic food diary. And then they use that information and put it into an algorithm which can help you to predict if you're going to have a negative or a positive glycemic response to a particular type of food. Right? So if I gave everyone in this room white toast, one piece of white toast right now, you'd have very different glycemic responses to that white toast. White toast is actually, based on dietitians, a high glycemic food. But that's an average. It's a high average glycemic food, right? Or average high. Now, that means, funnily enough, I don't know if anyone follows statistical theory, but if you have an average, 50% of the people are below it and 50% of the people are above it, right? And interestingly, with glycemic indexes, it's a really broad range. So you can have a really low response and a really high response. And understanding that and taking that on board can be very important. So if I just tell people to eat a low glycemic foods group, some of them might actually have very high glycemic responses to some of those food groups, some of the food types there. And so what they did is take the microbiome and showed that the microbiome produces chemicals in some people that alter how their body responds via the production of of insulin and incretin through the islet cells based on things like short-chain fatty acids and other small lipid molecules that the bacteria produce, which alter the transcription regulation in the islet cells and affect that hormonal regulation, which can alter your glycemic response to certain types of food. So it's an individual personalized response to the food. And so if you took a particular type of diet, like here we have muesli, sushi, marzipan, corn and nuts, and coffee and chocolate, right? Is that a healthier diet than this one, which has eggs and bread, which is what I had this morning, pita and hummus, edamame, and noodles and ice cream? Which one's healthier? Who says the one on the left? Who says the one on the right? Okay. No one knows, right? It's a total guess. Although he's like, I need the chocolate because I've been smoking up this morning. I get you, man. I get you. But it's virtually impossible to tell, right? There's good food groups and bad food groups as our basic understanding in both of those communities. In an individual, it might be the one on the right that might be better, right? The evidence is, and this is real data based on these two diets run in a study group, and this data I'm about to show is from one individual. So we're going to show the glycemic response daily to the individual food groups based on a diet that consisted of the left side in red, and then the glycemic response for a diet on the for the groups on the in green on the right. So here we see a glycemic response to the left diet, where you get these big peaks and troughs, peaks and troughs, peaks and troughs. And when you switch that person over to the right diet, which is what their microbiome, their microbial metabolic potential would suggest, you get a significant reduction in the peaks and troughs, significant leveling out of thy glycemic index response. So you don't get these blood sugar peaks and troughs on a regular basis. You get a more even, more measurable, and more standard response. That can be beneficial for reducing weight gain. It can be beneficial for lots of other things. In my mind, and I've been working in this industry now for 20 years, and I've launched 4 or 5 of my own companies. I wish I'd done this one. I have no financial interest with the company anymore. But in my mind, this is one of the few examples where people have taken microbiome data and actually done something useful in human health with it so far. There's lots of stuff coming out in cancer, but none of it's been applied yet. This is applied human health based on microbiome data. I'll finish there, just talking about my microbiome center, and also I wrote a book, and I'm legally bound to talk about it, so all dirt is good. Thank you very much.
We are running slightly late, but this is too good to not take advantage of Jack being here, so we'll take a couple of questions from the audience if you have some.
Yeah.
Can you comment on microbiome and Parkinson's?
Yeah, can you comment on microbiome and Parkinson's? Yes, I can. So there's a significant body of literature which suggests that there are microbial metabolic products and which can build up and lead to a significant shift in neurological in the neurological phenotype of Parkinson's. We do not know what the onset of that is. There's some suggestion it's based on disruption of mitochondrial function in some of the cell lines associated with onset, but we haven't yet proven it. There is a group out in Caltech, Sarkis Masmanian, who was a UChicago person, moved out there, who is has demonstrated in an animal model of Parkinson's that they can alter some of the neurological phenotypes, such as tremor, and some of the gastrointestinal phenotype by adding certain types of probiotic organisms which have particular metabolic properties. Not the kind of probiotics you can buy in the store, organisms which have been identified that have a particular property and are added back in and therefore cause a beneficial impact to the animal. None of that's been related back to people yet. But similar for Alzheimer's, we've shown that we can alter the microbial community in an animal and reduce the amount of beta amyloid plaque deposition, making the beta amyloid plaque more soluble and therefore more excretable, and therefore you get a reduction in nerve damage or neuron damage associated with that deposition. So it's very early stages in my mind, right? I hope it comes to fruition. I've got a family line of Alzheimer's and the genetic markers to prove it. Parkinson's is obviously a horrendous disease that needs, we need to find a solution. My hope is that we'll find the trigger, And we can determine the lifestyle characteristics for an individual which would reduce the likelihood of having that trigger, based on genetic predisposition. But at the end of the point, we are coming to the point maybe in the next 5 years when we'll have solutions that could treat symptoms.
We probably need to end the session. I'm not sure if anyone else is coming in into this room or not, but Jack, would you be willing to entertain some questions out in the hallway? We appreciate you coming. This has been a very fascinating presentation, and Jack will entertain questions outside in case there is someone else coming into the room. Thank you. Thank you, Jack.